The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 222, Genesis 1 and the Priestly Agenda, paper by Edwin J. Firmage, chaired by Margaret Toscano. This is a 60-minute session taped on a 90-minute tape, so the second half of Side 2 will be blank.
I'd like to go ahead and start this session so we have lots of time for discussion. Welcome to section, what is it, 222. I think I'm supposed to announce this thing for the tape. Yes, 222 with Edwin J. Firmage, Genesis 1 and the Priestly Agenda is the name of the paper. I'm very happy to chair this session. Ed Firmage is our speaker for this hour. He received his B.A. in Greek from the University of Utah. He has a master's degree in ancient history from Berkeley. Ed has also studied at several other universities, including Hebrew University in Jerusalem and also the American University at Cairo. Ed has also received a number of distinguished academic awards, fellowships, and so forth, to study at the Hebrew University, Berkeley, and elsewhere. He also has some impressive professional publications, including some contributions to the theological word book of the Old Testament. And also he has contributed to the Anchor Bible Dictionary and to some other publications in other scholarly journals. The article that we're hearing today is going to appear where? So we can look forward to that as well. I'll just go ahead and turn the time over to Ed. And then I think we'll have plenty of time for questions afterwards.
For those who are interested, the paper will appear in JSOT early next year. Don't know the exact date at this point, but that journal, I don't know if it's available here. It's probably available at BYU. I don't know if it is at the university. Yeah. Well, before I get into the paper itself, I thought it might be a good idea to just sort of set the stage as far as some basic assumptions go and make sure that everyone is operating from the same page, reading from the same page, I guess is the better metaphor. This paper obviously was intended for an academic audience, and certain of the assumptions that you kind of make going into a paper like this may not be as appropriate here. So let me first of all just tell you about the most basic assumption that I make here. And that is that although we can quibble about any number of details, scholars are almost universally agreed that the book of Genesis, and indeed the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, are a composite of compositions from different times and different people. And in particular, the book of Genesis is a composition of two primary strands, narrative strands. The first one is a strand designated by the letter J, because the in German scholarship, which created this designation, J was the letter with which Yahweh, the name of God, begins. The other primary contributor to Genesis was a priestly author designated by the letter P. And over the years, really the last 200 years, scholars have built up a vast literature on what belongs to P and what belongs to J. And by general consensus, the first chapter of Genesis belongs to P. The second creation story that starts in chapter 2 belongs to J. And even a very superficial reading of the text suggests that there are, in fact, some marked differences between the P narrative and the J narrative. We're going to focus on the P narrative, Genesis 1. If you're interested in the second chapter, I would highly recommend an article in the latest Sunstone by David Wright, a friend from Berkeley, which I think is one of the best presentations of the chapter I've ever read, long or short. These two make sort of interesting book covers on the topic of creation, very different points of view. So with that brief preface, I'll go ahead and launch into the paper. Maybe just one other thing I should say as a caveat. What I'm presenting to you here is new. It is not part of the scholarly consensus. I mentioned that Genesis chapter 1 is usually attributed to P. One of the things that I will talk about here is the notion that it in fact belongs to a slightly different priestly tradition designated by the letter H, which represents the Holiness Code. The Holiness Code is primarily contained in the last half of Leviticus, chapters 17 through 26. It is clearly part of a priestly tradition, but seems to differ with regard to at least one fundamental point, and that was the degree to which ordinary people, ordinary Israelites specifically, could be holy in some sense. The Holiness Code is called that because its real leitmotif is the notion of holiness. That's a theme that appears throughout the book, throughout the chapters in question. In P, which I think is probably an older priestly point of view, holiness is much more restricted. It's the property of, first of all, the tabernacle and the things that belong to the tabernacle, the furnishings. Of course, it is the preeminent property of God. And by extension becomes a property of the priests. But it is not shared by the Levites, nor is it shared by the people at large. And so it seems to have been along this line that P and H really differentiated from one another. Followers of P believing that holiness was a much more restrictive notion. Adherence to the H point of view, believing that holiness in some form, perhaps not well defined, could be extended to the people at large. And what I'm going to argue here, among other things, is that Genesis 1 really seems to be more of a kindred spirit with the H tradition, and in fact that it sets the stage for H by introducing the theme of holiness in a general human context. So, with that preamble, I'll go into the paper, and then at the end we can entertain questions. The title again is Genesis 1 and the Priestly Agenda. Scholars of the Hebrew Bible have long recognized that in spite of the considerable importance attached to it by later tradition, and in sharp contrast to the many theological developments derived from it in the post-biblical period, the creation has only a supporting role to play in Israelite writing and thought. While brief poetic allusions of a general sort to the creation theme are not infrequent, sustained literary and theological development of it is lacking in the Bible. Further, where the creation theme appears, it is usually telescoped into events connected with another dominant theme, such as the salvation of Israel. Summarizing the biblical evidence, Gerhard von Rath observed that the creation never attained to the stature of a relevant, independent doctrine. It is invariably related and indeed subordinated to soteriological considerations. If biblical writers and thinkers on the whole ignored the creation as a subject in its own right, why then do we have Genesis 1, a treatment of the subject on an unprecedented scale? And why is this story included with so little apparent follow-up elsewhere in the Bible? In view of von Rad's observation, it would appear likely that the answer to the first question is that despite its size, this narrative, like other shorter treatments of the creation theme, has a purpose beyond being a disquisition on creation. What precisely that purpose is will become apparent in the following discussion. As for the second question, this narrative's unusual scope and the consequent likelihood that it is here to explain something larger or something other than creation per se, suggests that there must in fact be a follow-up somewhere down the line, even if it has eluded us until now. Indeed, it is the follow-up that explains what the creation narrative is all about. Before turning to a fresh examination of the text, some discussion of the present explanations of Genesis 1 is in order. Consistent with the long-standing attribution of this text to a priestly source, Driver, S.R. Driver, summarizing the still dominant critical consensus, commented that it is part of an outline in which only important occurrences, such as the creation, the deluge, covenants with Noah and Abraham, are described with minuteness, and which is sufficient as an introduction to the systemic view of the theocratic institution which is to follow in Exodus to Numbers, and which is the main object of the author of this source. This summary statement is fine as far as it goes. However, its real value must be demonstrated in the details. What specifically in this narrative serves as a preamble to the cultic regulations of the priestly corpus? Perhaps the most common answer to this question is that the author wanted to assert the unity of God and his singular role in the creation of the universe. But the concerns of the priests, as evidenced by the extant priestly corpus, center on religious observance, not the promulgation of creedal documents. While the priests, of course, believed in the unity and singularity of God, theological assertions in the abstract are not characteristic of the priestly modus operandi. If there was a point to be made, it is more likely to have been connected with something essential to the priestly function. One might object that the centerpiece of the cult was the worship of the one God, and that that would justify, if not mandate, a priestly preamble outlining the historical rationale for a monotheistic creed. Yet this explanation has a ring of theological artificiality about it. By the time this document and the related priestly corpus proper were written, and for the present discussion, the date, early or late, of that composition is immaterial, the priests had no need to do battle with polytheism. The common assertion that Genesis 1 is a polemic designed to combat polytheism is therefore wide of the mark. Consistent with its monotheistic premise, Genesis 1 indeed avoids the naming of the sun and the moon, eschews any hint of theogony or personalization of the cosmic forces involved, and attributes the power of creation to God's fiat alone. Yet these elements of the story can scarcely have been the focal point for an author and an audience for whom polytheism was a dead letter. An academic broadside against paganism would scarcely have justified a priest's venturing into the realm of narrative composition. It is also said of Genesis 1 that it gives mankind a peculiar place in the created order as compared with what one finds in Near Eastern mythology. This is certainly true, too, but again, it is doubtful that our priestly author would have ventured into composition simply to assert mankind's special role over against the contrary pagan view. A polemical motive in this case would be even more unlikely than in the assertion of the unity of God, since God's purpose in creating mankind, to the extent that it is a matter of pure theology, had no direct bearing on religious practice, on which priestly attention was focused. If theological polemics are not a motivating factor in Genesis 1, maybe the concern of the text is simply to provide a synopsis of Israel's prehistory. Although perhaps characteristic of the primeval history, this is the early sort of prehistoric narrative of Genesis, as Jay conceived it, a concern with origins per se seems out of place in a priestly document. Moreover, Spicer, E.A. Spicer, rightly observes that a concern with origins would not necessarily dictate that one take the story all the way back to creation. If the focus were on the history of the Israelite people, for example, a more appropriate beginning would be Genesis 12. And in fact, the bulk of the J document really starts there. Spicer's alternative rationale is that the priestly author is concerned with society as the embodiment of an ideal that transcends national boundaries, and which therefore may be retraced to the beginnings of the world. While there is an important insight in this notion of society embodying an ideal, I hope to show that the motive for the story is, in fact, to set the context for an ideal that is uniquely Israelite and of direct relevance to the priests. That our author is not interested in discoursing on origins per se is also evident in the sketchiness of his cosmology. From a cosmological point of view, the striking thing about Genesis 1 is how little it tells us about the creation, except that God was responsible for it, and that it happened in such and such a sequence. How God did what he did, and indeed the details of what he really did, are not clear. For example, the text does not say that God created the light or the darkness, the waters of the deep, or dry land. He is certainly responsible for putting them in their present form, but how they came into being is unclear, an ambiguity that has provided opportunity for speculation ever since. Our author's apparent disinterest in the details of the creation is nowhere more evident than in the story of mankind's origin. In stark contrast to Jay's account that follows, which describes mankind's genesis in painstaking physical detail, our author simply has it that on the sixth day, God created mankind in his image. Even where mankind is concerned, the epitome of God's creative activity, almost nothing is said that would satisfy one's curiosity about human origins. The focal point of Genesis 1, and therefore the proper beginning for an analysis of the priestly author's intent, is of course the creation of humankind in the image of God. That this is the focal point of the story emerges from the way that it is set up as a unique event capping God's creative activity. The creation of mankind is unique, first of all, in not being brought about by fiat. The string of divine commands that had created everything else is broken with the unprecedented, "Let us make mankind in our image." It is unique in that God is more directly involved. While he brings other things into being by his word, he makes man, and of course, most importantly, does so in his own image. Mankind is further distinguished from the rest of creation by being given dominion over it. In a small way, mankind thus stands apart from it, as does God. The creation of mankind is the culminating creative event, the one event that cannot be omitted without fundamentally diminishing the story. But the creation of mankind in God's image is more than just the climax of this particular story. It is the foundation event for the entire priestly narrative. It is the leitmotif on which later narrative and legal elements will build. An appreciation of this connectedness to what follows in the priestly narrative is critical to our understanding of the author's intent. Our leitmotif occurs next in Genesis 9, which echoes chapter 1 in several respects. As before, God blesses mankind with fertility and reaffirms its rule over the animals. However, God also gives Noah an additional privilege. Whereas the first humans were allowed only fruits and vegetables as food, Noah and his progeny are now permitted to eat flesh, provided that they abstain from the blood, which is the carrier of the life force, belongs to God. As I have observed elsewhere, this is a paper that I did on the dietary law, and I can give you details on that if you're interested. God is giving up a portion of what had previously been his exclusive prerogative, the right to take life. God thus grants that Noah may act more like himself. Noah's unique relationship with God is reinforced by the covenant God subsequently makes with him and his descendants, God's first commitment of any sort to mankind, not to destroy them as he had their ancestors. Noah is therefore not only the image of God, but a prototype of the godlike man, a model whom God hopes future generations will emulate. And we have some indication of this, albeit very sketchy, in later books of the Bible where Noah and Daniel, in particular, are singled out as sort of paradigms of good behavior. But the priests were prepared to take the idea of man as the image of God even further. For the priests, of course, God is above all holy. His holiness, more than any other attribute, determines the nature of his interaction with mankind. The ultimate expression of mankind's likeness to God is therefore the idea that mankind, too, can become holy. This idea is epitomized in the priestly injunction that Israel is to become holy because God is holy. And this is actually a theme that repeats itself several times in Leviticus. If humankind and God bore no resemblance to one another, the injunction to holy would have no meaning. In priestly thinking, holiness does not inhere in objects other than the sanctity of God's tabernacle, nor is it localizable in the landscape, except again for the tabernacle. Neither is it an attribute of any animal. Between these things and God, there is no likeness. If humans can become holy, it is solely because they were created in the image of God. If there is indeed a connection between the priestly notions of mankind's being created in God's image and the injunction to be holy, then perhaps God was thought initially to have desired holiness not just of Israel, but of all people. Further, if holiness was considered by the priest to mandate certain rules of behavior, then ideally all people should have been subject to them. And so we come back to Spicer's notion of an ideal. By the time we get to the actual priestly corpus, of course, only Israel ends up having to observe such laws. Clearly something has gone wrong. Years ago, Martin Buber observed that the stories, the Toledot of Genesis, tell not only a story of a people's origins, but also of a succession of attempts on God's part to create a more intimate relationship with mankind based on principles of righteousness. The first of these attempts is, of course, with Adam and his descendants. Contrary to God's intent, this race fills the earth with violence that prompts God to destroy it. He saves one man and his family and establishes a covenant with them, something he had not done with Adam, at least in the biblical narrative, and grants them favors such as the privilege of eating meat. This race, too, for reasons still not entirely apparent, ultimately provokes God's anger. Presumably it's their pride, the Tower of Babel sort of thing. Having already promised never again to destroy mankind, God instead calls to one righteous man and sets him on a journey that will ultimately lead to the formation of a new people, among whom God can dwell and establish a proper social order. For Buber, this three-part story ends with Abraham and the covenant that God establishes with him. But the story cannot really end there, for as important as Abraham is, he too is but part of the preamble, whose ultimate purpose, as far as the priests are concerned, must surely be to set the stage for the revelation of the Torah on Sinai. It is at Sinai that the rules for godlike behavior, the holy life, are explicated at their fullest. Let me just make a digression here for a second. This is in stark contrast to our LDS view of affairs, in which what follows at Sinai is a compromise solution, a second place. But it's very clear from the biblical text that that is not what the priests thought, or indeed what any of the Israelite thinkers thought. If we restrict our investigation to the priestly portions of the revelation at Sinai, the first legislation regulating proper behavior is the dietary law of Leviticus 11. It is here, too, that we encounter the full-blown mandate for Israel to be holy. It's Leviticus 11:44. This conjunction is not accidental. In both instances where mankind is said to be in the image of God, food is a surprisingly prominent motif. Why, in a grand account of the creation of the world, such as Genesis 1, should food be mentioned at all? The mention here, of course, comes at the end, where God tells Adam and Eve, although they aren't called that there, that they can eat any seed-bearing fruit. Why in the second creation following the flood, the story of Noah, is it again brought to the fore, where God allows Noah to eat meat? If the focus of these narratives were simply to set the stage for subsequent Israelite history, or to combat polytheism, or indeed even to highlight the significance of mankind, why should food be a topic of discussion at all? Let me just pause again here and underscore this point. Between Genesis 1 and Leviticus 11, of course, there are any number of additional commandments that God makes to mankind. But in a critical view of this material, all of these things, and we're talking primarily here about Exodus, about the Ten Commandments and the following laws that are given, all of these things belong to other traditions. If we look strictly at the priestly contribution to the text, you have a sort of preamble in Genesis, then you have all this other material, including most of Exodus, and then you have more priestly material. And the first priestly material containing a commandment regulating general behavior is in Leviticus 11. The early part of Leviticus and the last part of Exodus that belong to P have to do with the establishment of the tabernacle and the regulations that surround that. So the regulations are very specific and very cultic in nature. It's only with Leviticus 11 that we break out into more general sort of ethical, behavioral prescriptions. So it's interesting that the first of these should in fact be the dietary law. And my point here is to emphasize that that conjunction is not accidental. So, you know, why is food so prominent a motif here? To answer that question, let us investigate the issues of diet and the godlike life in light of the succession of divine attempts to establish a relationship with mankind as portrayed in the priestly document. In antediluvian times, according to our author, human beings, like the animals, were supposed to eat only plants. By implication, animals have as yet no fear of humans, and the two live in idyllic, if naive, harmony. God at this point makes no demands of and gives no instruction to mankind. Thus left to their own devices, the first humans quickly become unruly and are eventually doomed by their own violence. There can be no question in this case of establishing holiness on earth. Even though created in God's image, mankind is a lost cause without instruction. God's next attempt to establish holiness therefore leads off with the first divine instruction. Mankind may not take life with impunity. This comes in Genesis 9. Individuals will now be personally liable for bloodshed. Significantly, this first commandment to humankind, this first explicit restriction on human behavior, is motivated by the statement that mankind is created in God's image. While God still reserves to himself the right to take human life, he grants mankind the right to take animal life. Denied the first humans, this right gives mankind an even more exalted position relative to the rest of creation. This new, more godlike status goes hand in hand with diet, and indeed makes no sense apart from it, for the purpose of the concession is to allow mankind to eat meat. Unfortunately, as before, God's attempt to foster a closer relationship to mankind fails. Apparently, the commandment against violence by itself is insufficient to turn mankind from its self-destructive tendencies. God's final and ultimately successful attempt starts with Abraham and is consummated at Sinai. It involves a new instruction on a massive scale, the whole priestly Torah, in concert with a correspondingly comprehensive new covenant. For our author, the key elements of this instruction are not only basic rules of ethical and moral behavior, but also those that introduce the concepts of purity and holiness. Among these latter, the dietary law is perhaps the most important. In the priestly view, the Israelites take a giant step forward when God gives them the dietary law of Leviticus 11. They continue to eat meat, but no longer indiscriminately as the other nations do. The observation of this restriction is one of the preconditions of the holy life. This is implicit in Leviticus 11:44. To appreciate why the priestly author of Leviticus 11 believed this to be so, it is necessary to understand how the dietary law came into being. And I'll depart from the written text here and quickly just summarize my view on the dietary law. The traditional explanation of the dietary law of Leviticus 11 has been that, it's been along two different lines. One you could call the hygienic explanation, which is that these things are prohibited because they are unhealthy. And this view has won adherence, including many prominent scholars. The great William Albright was one of these. The great Israeli, all right, I shouldn't say that, Jewish Philonides was an adherent of this view. And the animal that really made that explanation credible was the pig. The nasty habits of pigs fundamentally determined this hygienic view. But in fact, it can be shown that the hygienic explanation has nothing to do with the prohibition. There are any number of arguments that one can raise against it, but the most important is that if you bracket the pig and just look at the other animals, there's nothing particularly problematic about them from a dietary point of view, nor do the priests in general seem to have been concerned about hygiene for hygiene's sake, or health for health's sake. There are any number of harmful things that are not prohibited in the dietary law. So to make a long story short, I believe we can show unambiguously that hygiene and health are not motivating factors. The other explanation has it that the animals that are prohibited are somehow associated with pagan rituals. But here again, we stumble against the fact that the animals overwhelmingly that were used in pagan rituals were the same animals that were used in Israelite rituals, namely sheep and goats, cattle. So none of these sort of material explanations really work, and there are others, there are economic explanations and so forth, but in my view, what really is at work here is, again, this notion of the command to be holy. The Israelites are under this injunction to be holy, to imitate God, who is holy. And it occurred to somebody, one of the priests, that if that is true, then the Israelite diet ought to be modeled on the diet, if you will, of God. And what is the diet of God? It is the domestic livestock that are sacrificed. These define a paradigm of acceptable food from which criteria are derived. These are the criteria that are mentioned early in Leviticus 11 to distinguish animals that belong to the cattle category, the clean category, and everything else. So what's at work here fundamentally is an analogy. God eats this, therefore we should eat something like that. So unlike most of scholarship that has looked at Leviticus 11, I see a fundamental consistency between the legislation that we have here and this notion of holiness. And that leads me to view chapter 11 of Leviticus not as part of the priestly tradition, but as part of the age tradition. So we have this interesting and really quite unprecedented story of the legislation on diet. If you grant that Leviticus 11, in fact, may belong to the H tradition, and you put it up against the other legislation in H, that is chapters 17 through 26, you see just how unprecedented this chapter is. It's the longest single topic that is raised in the entire priestly corpus. This changes our view of the dietary law from being kind of an interesting little anthropological footnote. It becomes the centerpiece of the H view of the world. It's the lead-in chapter of H. It's the thing they start with. It's the longest. And as we can see, it has precursors in the book of Genesis that are critically important, determinative elements in the creation story. Suddenly, things seem to be kind of falling together here. So, as outlined here, pick up the narrative. The best place to get back into things here. We saw earlier that attempts to explain the presence of Genesis 1 at all, much less the peculiar attention it pays to the issue of food, founder on the fact that priestly interest focuses not on historiography or theology per se, but on daily religious observance. It's hard for us to appreciate this. You know, religion for us is so theological, so abstract and academic in many ways. The priests were not theologians. We don't have long sermons, and indeed there were no sermons in the Israelite cult. Some scholars have gone as far as saying the cult was entirely silent. There's not even any music in the cult. No cymbals, pipes, drums, whatever. So you have this very Spartan, silent temple ritual in which the priests are functionaries, not preachers. Certainly not theologians who sit down evenings and write long sort of academic discourses on speculative theology. So given the extraordinary emphasis that the H tradition places on diet as a means of teaching Israel about holiness, mention of diet in the priestly account of creation should no longer surprise us. Indeed, it is suggested here that one of the primary purposes of Genesis 1 was to set the stage for the dietary law that was to come in subsequent priestly legislation. What the priests set out to do in Genesis was to establish the philosophical underpinning of the dietary law, and indeed of all the holiness regulations contained in the so-called H document. The premise of these rules is the notion that Israel is to be a holy people, and this notion in turn rests on the idea that God created humankind in his image. For the priests of H, this notion is not a theological proposition in the abstract, but the starting point of a comprehensive agenda affecting every aspect of daily life. As subsequent events in the priestly narrative unfold, there will be ever-increasing restrictions on human space, time, and activity, until such time as mankind realizes the potential inherent in its divine beginning. As far as the priests of H are concerned, the way that mankind will develop its potential is through schooling in the concept of holiness. To the degree that people master that, they become more godlike. The priestly creation story therefore concludes not simply with divine rest, which is really the logical stopping point, but with the introduction of holiness into the world. Holiness enters the human sphere when God blesses his day of rest and makes it holy. The only other things God blesses in this narrative, or its echo in chapter 9, are animate beings. By implication, he therefore blesses the seventh day for the benefit of his living creation. If the focus of the creation narrative is on mankind, then the seventh day too must ultimately be designed with the benefit of mankind in mind. Likewise, in the priestly tradition, the only other things God ever sanctifies are the priests and the appurtenances of the sanctuary. The seventh day, like the sanctuary, and it's sort of a sanctuary, involves a separation of something from its environment. At this point, the impact and the extent of holiness on human affairs is very limited. But in God's subsequent interaction with mankind, the reach of the holy will be extended, temporally, spatially, and behaviorally. Temporally, new holy days will be established to mark other acts of God, such as the Passover. Spatially, holiness will be introduced to the creation of a dwelling place for God on earth, the tabernacle. Behaviorally, holiness will be promoted by defining what people may eat, how they handle impurity, how they worship, etc. The early attempts to do this fail, but at Sinai, God finally achieves his objective. Holiness, in the strictest sense, is bestowed upon the priests. These, in turn, through dietary and other legislation, are to assist the Israelites at large in their progress toward becoming a holy people, recalling God's stated intent that Israel is to become a regime of priests and a holy nation. Priests were not theologians, nor about mankind's origins per se. They were also not historians. Rather, the story is part of a teaching document that will show the Israelites, the people whom God has desired to set apart, how they, through their own actions, can make that setting apart a reality. This setting apart at first is largely in potential, much as was the blessing of mankind in Genesis 1. When God creates the material universe, his word immediately becomes reality. When God creates mankind, he empowers it with the potential to become something. Something is yet only partially realized. Mankind, being created by God in his own image, has the potential to become in some way more like God, as a son can become like his father. And here we have the interesting connection between the words used to describe mankind in God's image and Seth, Adam's son, being created in his image, a connection that is certainly not accidental. God empowers mankind to reproduce, thereby giving it the power to create images of itself, also in imitation of God. Finally, God gives mankind charge of his creation. The proper use of these divine gifts, informed by instruction in the nature of God, which is holiness, will enable mankind more fully to mirror its creator. God's purpose in creating mankind, to have an image of himself, is only fully realized when mankind responds to this holy vocation. We'll skip a little bit here. So that's the bulk of the paper, minus all the interesting footnotes. And with that, turn it over to you for questions. Yeah. Of course, we don't really know for sure, but the view that I subscribe to is that H is a later tradition. A subset of the priests, clearly sharing a lot of the same basic ideas and history, but different, at least in regard to this idea of how far holiness can extend. And if you think about it, I mean, if you look at Genesis, you've got these two big blocks of stuff. You've got the early part, which has to do with the sanctuary, and all of the regulations about sacrifice and that sort of thing. The purity purity laws for so-called leprosy and other things, sexual impurity. Then you have this other block of stuff, which looks very different. It's clearly priestly in nature. It has a lot of the same kind of language, but it's much more discursive. It's more more in the way of preaching. That's what you find in 17 through 26 of Leviticus. So it's it's a stylistic difference, too. Got a group of sort of nuts and bolts guys and a group of more theological types. Still not theologians. I think what I said here still stands. But more given to letting their ideas kind of take their natural flow. And if, in fact, that difference is a real one, then you look at Genesis and you see something that clearly is not legislative in nature. It seems to be much more akin with 17 to 26. Stylistically, although there it's harder to say because you are dealing with different material, and you could argue that, you know, any stylistic difference is a matter of the form. You know, when you speak poetry, you know, you adopt a different form than if you're writing a letter. But the very fact that they would take that different form is itself interesting. And that's why I think Genesis 1 and H are kindred spirits. Now, the one thing I skipped here at the end, which is important, I probably should have read it, is the sort of critical conclusion. The most interesting thing is the thematic conclusion that Genesis was motivated, Genesis 1 was motivated by this holiness consideration. But the critical conclusion is also interesting. Let's look at kind of what we have in the Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and we can say parts of Numbers. We have a starting point, which we've said now is priestly. We have all this other stuff, and then we have some more priestly stuff. What this suggests is that H is, in fact, one of the key redactors of Genesis. That it is H that has framed the whole Exodus tradition, the whole primeval history, the whole Book of the Covenant, the legislation following the Decalogue. And why is he framing it with Genesis on the one end and his own legislation and Leviticus on the other? To show how all of Israel's legislation, including this other stuff that he knows is not his, but he regards as holy, you know, holy tradition, how all of this leads up to the logical conclusion that Israel is to be a holy people. So it's to H that we owe the narrative structure that we have, at least in Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus. Deuteronomy is kind of its own thing. It's a world of its own. And Numbers is also kind of a mixed bag. A lot of it is priestly. So the story isn't just cut and dry, but we can certainly say that H, the likely author of Genesis 1, is in fact the redactor, one of the key redactors of the Bible. And suddenly we begin to see that the organization of the Pentateuch that we have is not accidental. It is thematic. And the theme that drives it all is this concept of holiness. It's hard to say. In the strict priestly view, which P represents, which we find in the early parts of Leviticus, holiness is, you know, is very restricted. It's what characterizes God, his sanctuary and everything in it, and the people who work in it, the priests. That's it. It's a force. I wouldn't go that far, but they don't derive the full range of implications that they could. And I think you could view H as kind of a natural outgrowth of things that are inherent even in the priestly view, but that don't really find expression right away. The reason I say that is that in the view of Jacob Milgram, my teacher at Berkeley, the sacrificial legislation is also kind of a teaching thing. It's been stripped of a lot of its sort of strict anthropomorphic elements, although they're clearly there. What is the purpose of sacrifice in P? Well, the so-called sin offering has as its purpose the purification of the sanctuary from the sins of Israel. And Milgram has a great piece called The Priestly Picture of Dorian Gray, which is the notion that, if you remember Oscar Wilde's book, this guy, Dorian Gray, goes out and can sin and suffers no consequences. But there's this picture of him sitting up in the attic, or in his house originally, and then increasingly in the attic, where he can see the progress, his progress toward total dissolution. Every sin that he commits, you know, the painting gets that much uglier. And in Milgram's view, that's what the sanctuary is. It's the symbolic representation of the state of Israel's soul. When they sin, their sins adhere to the sancta, the altar, the things inside the tent itself. And the purpose of the sin offering, so-called, is to the sanctuary. Now, there's an interesting theology there, a very sophisticated thought. But the priests of P don't really develop that in any sort of discursive way. The priests of H are more inclined to do that, and their starting point seems to have been diet. There are some versions of the Bible that are color-coded. I don't know if there's any sort of book sort of collection of just priestly stuff. It'd be an interesting thing to do. Yeah. Yeah, it's hard even in the critical studies. Some of the German scholar named Eliger did his study of Leviticus, which isn't all that interesting, frankly, with different typefaces. And when you look at his sort of super critical view of the text, it's frankly hard to read because he has so many different fonts. It's a real exercise in typography, and they did this before computers. It must have been a nightmare. Well, in priestly, in Israelite thought, as in, you know, a lot of cultures today, there wasn't a clean division between your life as a religious person and your life, the rest of your life. It is sometimes said in Christian circles, you know, the criticism is thrown at Jewish and biblical culture, that it's legalistic, that it's concerned with legal minutiae. But in my view, that's fundamentally misinterpreting the text, because what you have here is a sketchy story about legislation for life. It's easy for Christians to throw that criticism at a Jew because we don't live our religion day in, day out, the way they do. For a long time now, Christians have had a secular view of the world, and a religious view of the world. And for the most part, we live in the secular. And we feel uncomfortable. We notice as very different those few Christian groups that really do live a way of life that is distinctive, like the Quakers. Well, the Jews have that way of life, and perhaps the Israelites had that way of life. So what you find in here is regulation for daily life, to be lived in a way that is consistent with your philosophical presuppositions. We do it in our own way, but it's ad hoc and it's individual. So I don't think that it would be fair to say that it is, you know, just a matter of obedience or that it's mindless. It's just a daily sort of thing. It's ordinary. It's not set apart for a Sunday. All of which, however, comes later. All of which comes later. There's no biblical evidence that the meat milk issue arose. In fact, I don't think it was present even as late as Jesus' time. That's a later, though very interesting, outgrowth of sort of biblical precursors. Likewise, there's no mention here in the biblical text about, you know, washing things or anything like that. So the issue of what motivates the Jewish developments is another one, but I think you could probably also explain that on non-hygienic terms. Why does it matter? Yeah, I think we can say here that although it is different, the priestly, the P view of God and of religion is really much more like what we find in the rest of the Near East. It's profound. It, you know, may or may not be more interesting, but it's recognizably part of that tradition for all its differences. H, on the other hand, is something pretty unique. It has taken the notion of sort of the numinous. I mean, it's not as though purity and sanctity were not also present in pagan tradition. Clearly they are. But for H, holiness becomes an ethical mandate. And to my knowledge, that is not present anywhere else in the Near East. So what we're seeing in H and in Genesis is really the uniquely Israelite view that this old notion of sanctity has an ethical dimension, and that that ethical dimension has implications for human behavior.
I understand that the
By implication, it is similar to, but still distinct from, everything that follows, everything that precedes the holiness legislation. All of the stuff in the Decalogue, in the Book of the Covenant, which regulates sort of day-to-day, you know, good behavior. All of that is a necessary but not sufficient condition of holiness. Holiness is an attribute unique to God. And to be holy, you need to do all these other things. But doing all these other things doesn't necessarily get you to holiness. That is something that is unique to God. And if you get it at all, it is simply by virtue of His giving it to you. So it isn't well defined. It requires a certain kind of behavior, but it isn't the behavior. It is in part ethical, but in part still kind of involved in this notion of numinous power. It's power. But it's kind of a complex of ideas, but I think that the important thing is that it is God's unique quality, and therefore something that only He can impart to the extent that that is even possible. And ultimately, there is some divide between, you know, mankind and God. And we will never attain, in this view anyway, to the degree of holiness that God has. We get it sort of by very indirect absorption, but that at best. A good point. Certainly the latter. But I think it would also be fair to say it extends to the individual as well. Because ultimately these rules are rules for individual behavior. Individual priests have this quality of holiness to some degree. Individual Israelites who live as mandated here presumably can enjoy a measure of that as well. But at another level, it certainly applies to a people rather than to individuals. Maybe we should break and we can kind of go out in the hall and talk about this further. Thanks.